This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
Of all the human senses, the sense of smell, I think, has to be the most underrated. Most of us put so much emphasis on what we can see and hear that it's really easy to forget how powerful scent can be, how the vague fragrance of something like a perfume can completely recreate the feeling of a day in your life from 20 years ago and utterly floor you. Michael Edwards describes perfume as liquid emotion. Michael's known internationally as the perfume expert's expert. He wrote a book some years ago called Perfume Legends, which revealed for the first time how perfumes are made and their secret ingredients. His reference book, Fragrances of the World, is used as the industry Bible. Michael lives in Sydney, Paris and New York. I spoke to him on one of his rare visits home. Michael Edwards, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you, Richard.
Why do you call fragrance liquid emotion?
Because one sense of smell is so emotional.
So deeply emotional.
Totally emotional.
It can floor you, the remembered scent of something from years and years ago.
I think that's what fascinated me about smell. I mean, one of the things that I so like about it is that despite all the management skills, all the bean counters' knowledge, all the research that's put into it, we still can't predict success. I love that.
What kind of an art is the art of perfumery? There's so much science there, but it's mainly an art, isn't it?
It is an art, such as music, such as painting, such as sculpture. It's an applied art. I wish I could tell you that I could tell you exactly what makes a great perfume. I can't. We can do everything right, but at the end of the day, it's up to the women and the men who actually wear it. We know what a great perfume must do. We know that to start, it must be very soft, very appealing, like putting on a cashmere shawl. If there's too harsh a note in it, forget it. It has to be tenacious. Most people want their perfumes to be far more tenacious than the scientists can actually do. But nevertheless, they want it to last and last and last and last. But above all, when a woman wears it, it must have a signature. Somebody must say to her, "That's a beautiful scent you're wearing," or "I love that." If there's no response, chances are she won't buy it again there, because it's like talking and nobody answers you.
Yes, how should it approach someone? Because obviously a perfume shouldn't barge its way into into a social interaction, nor should it, you know, creep in too slowly.
In the 1980s, we had the big molecule perfumes. These were the perfumes that entered the room before you came in, and long after you left, there was still a hint there. We're in an era now of far more subtle perfumes. I mean, clearly, you would not want to be overwhelmed by a scent in a lift. There is this perception that people should not be able to smell your scent any further than if you hold your arm out, for example. If it's further than that, chances are that you're wearing something far too potent for other people's tastes.
Why is the world of modern French perfume so new? What is different about this new era of emotive perfume, as you call it?
If I briefly look back, we're going through four different stages of perfumery. For us, modern perfume started in 1889 with the creation by Guerlain of a perfume called Jicqui. When I say modern, until Jicqui, the perfumers were trying to capture the scent of a rose or crystallize the scent of jasmine. In other words, replicate nature. Jicqui was the first abstract perfume. It didn't try to imitate nature, it tried to add a new dimension to nature. Aimé Guerlain, the perfumer, when asked why did you use some synthetic notes, he said, "Because they gave me an effect which I couldn't get in nature." Until the 1940s, though, perfume was dominated by the perfumers. Jacques Guerlain, for example, who created Chalimar, Mitsuku, Le Bleu, François Coty, the great man who really produced modern perfumery. They did not rely on marketing techniques. They produced what they liked, and if you and I bought it, they probably made it again. By the end of the 30s, they'd either retired or died. François Coty had died by that stage, a bankrupt man. And the perfume industry passed to what we call the next stage, perhaps the great entrepreneurs. These were businessmen of huge taste. Think of Serge Heptalowicz, who created Parfum Christian Dior in 1947. In America, think of Estée Lauder, who transformed American perfumery in just 11 years from plonk to genius. Or Charles Revson. I mean, these were businessmen, businesswomen first and foremost, but they had an incredible sense of their customers' likes and dislikes. And they transformed the world. Charlie, in 1973, was the first catalyst. Until Charlie, men gave women a gift. Women really bought perfume for themselves, and they really wore it outside of high days and holidays and special days out. For the first time, though, Charlie persuaded a generation of young women to buy perfume for themselves, and by the end of the 70s, they were spending more money on buying perfume for themselves than men were spending on giving it to them. And that, I think, is what persuaded the great multinationals to come a goblin. And from the late 1970s to the late 1990s, every multinational worth its salt had a gobble, whether it's Colgate or Procter & Gamble or Unilever. There's only two surviving now, but they transformed the business and they turned it into a global business, $30 billion. Along the way, unfortunately, they became hostage to the stock exchange, and so sales became the dominant theme, and so in many cases, fine perfume turned into commodity perfumes. But one of the marvels about perfume is that as soon as somebody gets used to something, they want something better. And so that, I think, is one of the key reasons why, at the end of the day, marketing doesn't work. You've got to come up with something that intrigues people's imagination, their taste, their senses. And for me, at the moment, we're in the fourth generation, the new golden age. It's been spurned by what we call little niche fragrances. The French don't like that word because in France, niche means a dog kennel. But to the rest of us, it's a new generation of perfumery. And in 1972, for example, a young Revlon marketing manager stood up in front of the American Society of Perfumers. And she said, "To you, perfume is an art. You talk about it in terms of music and harmonies and accords. To women, my customers, it's a scent, a smell. They go to a counter, they pick up a tester, yuck. They go to another counter, pick up a tester, their eyes open, a sale is made, and marketing has probably made the difference." She threw down the marketing gauntlet, and the next year, 1973, Charlie was born, and the marketing revolution was upon us. One of the great perfumers of that era, Edmund Rudnitska, said, "Well, anybody can create a smell, but will you persuade somebody to buy it again there?" And he was right. But nevertheless, the marketing era was on us. In 1977, we had the first blockbuster, Opium. In many ways, there's an analogy between fragrance and movies. For example, in movies, 1976, if you remember. No, long before that, Jaws. First time it had really exploded. 1977 was there. But in 1978... a perfumer, Jean-François Laporte, in an anti-marketing revolution, created L'Artisan Parfumer. He went back to the traditions of artisanal nature. He sold that, 84, created Matra Parfumerie Gontier. Meanwhile, Annick Goutard was 1981, Etro 1989, Serge Lutin's 1992. Here you're talking not about marketing, it's the act of creation, using intriguing notes, no market research, no testing, and it's created a new generation of very interesting scents that is changing our world.
So we're in this phase at the moment. The last century has been this galloping technology when it comes to perfume.
Yes.
Going back before then, before the arrival of Gigi, this perfume that changed the whole perfume industry, women were wearing perfume, but what kinds of perfume were they wearing?
Mainly light natural ones.
Lavender water, that sort of thing.
Lavender water, rose water. To the ladies who dictated the tastes of Victorian era, if a lady wore anything other than a hint of a violet or a touch of lavender, she probably wasn't a lady. There's a story of the Queen Victoria was criticized because when she made her state visit to France, the couturiers picked up the fact that there was a touch of musk in her scent, and they decried that. Gigi for us was an incredible transformation. It was an abstract perfume, something quite different.
What was in Gigi then that made it so different from lavender water and rose water?
A couple of new synthetic notes which had been coming along. And the moment I mention synthetic note, everybody says, "Oh, that's got to be cheap." It's not. The magic of 20th and 21st century perfumery lies in this catalyst between synthetic notes and natural notes. You know, natural notes are beautiful, Richard, but the reality is that there are only about 80 or 90 of them. And if you insist that the perfumers merely use natural notes, two things would happen. You'd get very bored because chances are you would have smelt a variation on it before. And secondly, they're not very tenacious. They don't last. They're very volatile. For us, the magic of the new of modern perfumery lies in its use of the synthetic materials that were starting to be evolved in the late 19th century. That's really what happened. And when I talk synthetic, 95% of those notes come from nature. If you and I broke apart the scent of jasmine, you'd probably find over 800 different chemicals that nature has put together to create the scent.
800?
Over 800. And the fact is that each of those has got a slightly different scent. Some are yucky, some are incredible, some are unusual. But once you can't extract them commercially, clearly. But once you know the chemical structure, you can clone them. And that's where we get our synthetic notes coming from.
What is in perfume, most perfumes? What do they tend to have in common, Michael?
Like any great work of art, it all comes down to a big idea. It sounds so easy. You look at a Picasso, you look at a Rembrandt, you look at a Monet, you hear a Stravinsky symphony. You recognize it. Why? What is the difference between that and some potboiler that you've seen elsewhere? You read a book that intrigues you, you pick up another book and you're totally bored. What is it? It's that old thing in art, a big idea. It sounds so easy, but in reality it's so tough. When you come to perfumery, we start with an accord. That's really the heart of it. I mean, at the end of the day, we're looking for a theme, something which has a signature. Once you've got that, you can dress it up like an overture of music. That's the top notes, what you first smell, usually quite volatile notes. And then you add some elements that will make it last, like on a hi-fi, you can turn up the bass or the volume. We do that in the bass notes. But at the end of the day, you're talking about a marriage, a mixture, an accord, as we call it in perfumery, of two or three notes. Take Samsara by Guerlain. Here you've got the accord of a very strong Indian jasmine linked to sandalwood. Now, you may say, well, hasn't anybody done that before? Well, they have, but the problem with sandalwood is that you cut it down and you have to leave it for 2 or 3 years before you can extract the oils. They're just not good if they're younger. And the trouble is that by that time, they've lost all their freshness, and it's a very heavy, animalic note. The old perfumers would often say that sandalwood flattens a perfume, whereas patchouli explodes it. And so it wasn't until the scientists at a perfumery called Firmenich came up with some recreated that sandalwood top, fresh top notes, that they were able to put this mixture together of putting back into the sandalwood oil what nature, the angels, had taken away. And so for the first time, Jean-Paul Guerlain and Gérard Antony at Firmenich were able to use a mixture of almost 25% of sandalwood oil, way beyond what anybody else had ever used. And they balanced that with jasmine. So that's a typical accord. For me, a great perfume largely is an overdose. It's not just a harmonious balance. It's usually an overdose of one or two materials to create a signature, which is so unusual that when you wear it, other people say, wow, what's that?
So like in any great painting, that's the bold brushstroke. Sure. Yep. That's the thing. Too much of something.
Yep.
And then that's what counterbalanced by something else.
Very often.
A big, big note that's then harmonized with something else.
Exactly.
Chanel No. 5 is often regarded as one of those perfumes that was a signature perfume, an important perfume that came along in the 1920s, ordered up by Coco Chanel, who wasn't a parfumier, if that's the word for it. How was that created, and what goes into that bottle, and what made it so distinct?
Oh, the origins of Chanel No. 5. Coco Chanel, if you recall it, it was in 1919. She had an affair with an Englishman, Boy Capel. He'd left her. His family insisted that he marry an English aristocrat to beget an heir for the family fortune. Coco Chanel, of course, had come from an orphanage. She was not suitable in English society at that stage. He died tragically the following year. I found his will in Somerset House. He left her a great deal of money, but equally well, she was quite wealthy from her clothes. But she took up with a young man, 20 years her junior, very distinguished title, Grand Duke Dmitri, grandson of one of the last Russian Tsars. Legend has it that he was involved in the assassination of Rasputin, whatever. He came to Paris, little money, and Coco Chanel did what every sensible woman ought to do. She took him in, gave him ballet, clothes, apartment. You know, when I was reading about this, I was thinking, why didn't that happen to me when I was young? Anyhow, Chanel believed that it was he who actually probably gave her the idea other perfume. Because he was familiar with perfume from the Russian court there, it was in 1920, in fact, when she was summering at the Carlton Hotel in Cannes, just where the film festival has been held. She was summering there with Monsieur Sir, a great friend of hers who introduced her to the world of letters and art. Monsieur Sir was married to a painter, a Catalan painter. She was muse to many of the painters of the time there. She says that it was she who suggested the idea of a perfume, but Chanel says it was probably the young Grand Duke. It was the young Grand Duke, though, who probably introduced Coco Chanel to the perfumer, the Russian-born but French perfumer, Ernest Beau, who created the perfume. He was a very reticent man. He really spoke outside, and I know when I was doing my research, I had great deal of difficulty in trying to find out his letters, speeches that he'd given. His archives are held by his daughter-in-law, Madame Gilberte Beau, redoubtable lady. She's one of the wealthiest bankers in France, and she wasn't about to allow me entree into the archives. It took about 18 months before I got it. But when I did, I found a couple of speeches in which he spoke about the work. He recalls that Coco Chanel had come to see him. She said that she wanted a perfume, as Monsieur Serre wrote in her autobiography, a summery, as fresh as a summery morning. Lots of flowers. But, she said to Beau, it has to last. Like my clothes, it must be capable of being worn from first thing in the morning to last thing at night. Well, because she wanted a flowery scent, he created one for her. And she liked it. He presented it to her in a collection of 10 bottles. We think it was variations on two different themes, because there was one set numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and another set numbered from 19, 20, 21, 22, 23. She selected two of those perfumes. One was in the bottle number 22, which she introduced in 1922 under that name, but the other one was in the bottle, guess what, number 5. It was purely a number attached to it there. And Monsieur Beau recalls asking her, in a speech, he said, "What do you propose to call it, mademoiselle?" And he recalls her answer was immediate, instinctive. "Number 5," she said, pointing to the label. We don't know why number 5 was Coco Chanel's lucky number. There is a story that in the orphanage, because, you know, she had a tragic childhood. Her mother died when she was 12. Her father abandoned her to an orphanage a few weeks later, and she was raised there. And there is a story that in the refectory hall, the floor had a mosaic with symbolic numbers, and 5 was one of them. True, we don't know, because it's been destroyed, torn down there. On the other hand, Jacques Wirth, the man behind Wirth Perfumes, insists that 5 was the number of the horse on which she first won a great deal of money. So whatever it was, certainly it was an important number, because she would always present her collections on the 5th day of the 5th month, the 5th of May each year there. And so that became it. But the perfume we now know as number 5 was probably not the one she selected, because she was becoming more and more worried about the possibility that other people could imitate her perfume like they were already copying her clothes. And she pushed Beau to do something to make it different. At the end, he said, "About the only thing I can offer you is to make it so expensive no one can afford to imitate it." She said, "Do it." So he added a lot more of jasmine, one of the most expensive ingredients, but it made it too flowery and made it colored the liquid to a point where he had to refine it, and that added to an already expense one. And it really transformed it to a nice but flowery, too jasmine-y thing. So he was looking to add something else. He added a touch of ylang ylang, a very high grade of it there. But then he wanted something to make all the richness of the flowers sing. Vanilla, too sweet. Woods, probably too heavy. The aldehydes sound synthetic, they are, but they come from rose and citrus oils, trace amounts. They'd been identified in the early 1900s, so he wasn't the first to use them. But they smell pretty horrible. Some of them smell like a snuffed-out candle. But when you add a little bit to the flowers, they make the flowers sing. With a note so sharp, so fresh, literally they make the whole flowery thing come to life. Well, he added 10 times more than anybody else had ever added in this one, made the flowers sing, balanced it then with some iris and some musky notes underneath, and created number 5, one of the great classics.
Going back in your own life, Michael, can you think of the first notable perfume you can remember, and one that still has an effect on you? that early on had an impact on you that still has an impact on you?
Oh, absolutely. Today. Chanel No. 5 and Soie de Paris, because my mother wore them. And then I remember when I was in my late teens, I got seduced by Revlon's Intimate fragrance. That was not cheap at that time. And I always remember the line, cherished as one of the world's 7 great fragrances. I never discovered what the other 6 were. And then when I first came to Paris as a student, and there I smelt Eau Sauvage and Abbey Rouge. Oh, that was incredible.
It's traditionally women dab perfume behind their ears and on their wrist. Is that the right place to dab
perfume? On the wrist is fine, not behind your ears, because behind your ears you've got glands, quite similar to the glands in your genital region. So below the ears. The idea of on your wrist is wherever you have the pulse points, wherever the blood is closest to the skin, in other words, wherever you see the veins, that's probably the best part. So that would be on the wrist, at the elbow, nape of the neck. Behind the knees is a very good one, because scent rises. I mean, one of the nice things behind the ear is you may smell it for a while, but probably the angels are the only ones who really get the benefit.
Would you ever say to someone you met at a party, look, you really shouldn't be wearing that perfume?
Good God, no. Would you?
No. I'm not an expert.
I'd probably get slapped across the chops.
You might think it, though, occasionally, of course, without saying it.
Of course
it.
We always do that.
How did you find out so much about perfume and write so much about what goes into them? Because the perfume companies are notoriously secretive about their ingredients, their recipes, if that's the word.
I don't know. As I look back into my career, I think it's magical. I'm very lucky. I look back and wonder how I did it, but it does happen. If you're willing, if you're passionate and you're willing to keep on talking and asking questions, eventually I guess you do get the answers.
How did the industry react to your guide when you produced it?
With caution. But most of my work came from retailers. It was Nordstrom, the American department store in 88, who got hold of a copy and said, oh, we like it, add American perfumes. Then 1991, they said, can you add men's fragrances? Because until that stage, I was only on women's. And in 1998, they said, can you add the new niche fragrances? They wanted to put an Écoutal into one of their great stores. Obviously, anybody can produce a guide, but would the great houses like Chanel or Saint Laurent or Estée Lauder or Calvin Klein agree? That forced me to check it. Nobody else was doing that. But obviously, the only way that I would get entree is if I were impartial. And so to this day, we make no charge for listing. I don't accept advertising or sponsorship. But as a result, I'm the only one who can work with every brand and every perfumer. And the reason I have this marvelous lifestyle between New York and Paris and Sydney, if you wonder about Sydney, why, by the way, it's because it's neutral territory. If I were in Paris all the time, I'm not sure that my American colleagues would feel as comfortable with me as they are, because the French can make the Americans feel uncomfortable at times. And if I were in New York, then the French, being what they are, would get knickers in a twist. Everybody loves Sydney in Australia. My wife is Australian, and I continue to love the place. So it's a great thing. Anyhow, because I'm neutral and impartial, I can work with everybody. But when I did my first guide, there were only 38 new perfumes. Last year, we tracked over 1,100. So just to keep track of them is why I have to keep moving.
And just finally, where do you stand on the issue of men's fragrance?
They're even more interesting today than women's.
Do you wear them yourself?
Of course, yes.
Because that's often controversial whether men should wear fragrances or not. Some men feel very strongly against the whole idea of...
Well, that's usually older men.
Not you. Michael, it's wonderful to meet you, sir. And fantastic to talk to you. There's still so much we need to talk about. I hope to get you on the program again one day.
It'll
and find
pleasure.
Out more about this extraordinary world of perfumes. Thank you so much.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
I spoke to Michael Edwards, the perfume expert's expert, in 2010.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.